From Joel C. Rosenberg, the New York Times best-selling author of The Last Jihad and Epicenter, comes a must-read new book, Inside the Revolution. Using exclusive interviews with top intelligence officials, generals, and Mideast leaders, Inside the Revolution takes you inside the world of radical Islamic leaders, their hatred of Jews and Christians, their apocalyptic religious beliefs. Inside the Revolution, on sale now from Tyndale House Publishers. Available now at joelrosenberg.com.
Morning, glory and grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for listening to the program today. A program which I continue my series of conversations with Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett. Dr. Barnett is the author of the brand new book, Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. His previous bestseller, The Pentagon's New Map, reshaped a lot of strategic thinking in the United States. Great Powers attempts to do the same thing about the world in which we are living after President Bush, the dawn of the era of Obama. Dr. Barnett, welcome back to the program. This week we're doing Chapter 7. It's our sixth conversation. I want to start off with a quote from page 342. Right. We can't win this struggle with guns. We can't win it by ourselves or with a small fraction of humanity we call the West. We can't win it with a focus on just terrorism and democracy. We can't secure this most fantastic victory, a truly global liberal trade order, by demanding states leapfrog from their sheltered, disconnected past and into an immediate present that matches our level of globalization connectivity, our level of free markets, and our level of political pluralism all at once. The key phrase there is that you're identifying as the goal of American grand strategy, then, a global liberal trade order. Why is that the overarching goal?
Well, you know, back to the history discussion we had several weeks back, you know, it was first the diagnosis of Theodore Roosevelt that, you know, America couldn't be America unless it tried to spread on a global basis the same rules that animated our interactions here within the United States. So it's, you know, it's very Marxian in the sense, you know, Karl Marx said humanity has this natural ambition to kind of remake the planet in their image. And I think we've just been the most successful species in that regard in a global political system. I mean, the Europeans had their efforts and their attempts and their empires and their version of globalization, but that one self-destructed, very much according to Lenin's diagnosis, whereas ours has proven to be far more expansive, far more enriching and empowering, and I would argue over time far more attractive. People really like the possibilities of reinvention and freedom and individual ambition unleashed. So,
how much pushback do you get when you are explicit? And I, by the way, I agree that this is an important defining characteristic of what we're about, a liberal international trade order. But how much pushback do you get from, I don't want to call them nativists, but from protectionists and from isolationism, which is a very American tradition, as is liberal expansionism?
Well, or the one they really tag you with is exceptionalism. They say, and that swings both ways, that argument. They say, America is exceptional. And if you go too far down that path, then you're kind of into Sam Huntington territory. We're exceptional only on the basis of the Anglo-Saxon connection and certain cultural influences. But my argument would be, you know, yes, we had certain birthrights and certain lessons and influences that we took, most notably from the British, definitely in terms of the Glorious Revolution, most definitely in terms of the Dutch, who kind of pioneered this, free market for ideas, free market for commerce, free market for religious competition. But we've been able to blend in, you know, I make this phrase, we blend the best and we discard the rest in kind of a brutal remix. That is the definition of our synthetic culture. And as much as people are attracted to that, they're at once repelled by it to a certain extent, because they look at it and they say, well, that's the weird, exceptional freedom that America has foisted upon itself. It's not what's going to happen to my Ireland or my France or my Germany or whatever. But in reality, all those countries are experiencing the same kind of pressures, the same kind of inflows of immigrants and whatnot, forcing themselves to redefine their definition of, you know, who can be a Frenchman. Well, theoretically, only the French can be a Frenchman. But that's where our synthetic culture, our exceptionalism really is a gift that keeps on giving. Anybody can be an American, and being an American can incorporate virtually, you know, does, any cultural influence from around the world. So as much as they fear sort of our influence, I mean, it's really our example and our willingness to defend our example and our willingness to spread our example, because we do think we're exceptional, But to say that doesn't mean that the future of globalization is a future that looks like America necessarily, because America itself is under constant reinvention. As we take in more Latinos, we take in more Asians, we are constantly changing the mix. You know, I think we're probably closer to a future global culture than anybody else out there, but, you know, I don't hazard a prediction that says it's going to be based on us and us alone. So the exceptionalism, I say, is always one of not that we're the only ones who can do this, not that we're the only ones who can make this happen, but that as an experiment of connectivity, and I always say don't bet against humanity's desire to connect with others in all forms. I mean, we're just tremendously social creatures. We're the furthest along in this experiment. And that's all I invest in my exceptionalism here as an American. We're the furthest along in this experiment. So that begets certain responsibilities for us, especially during crises like now.
Now, I got to ask you, Dr. Barnett, this is the chapter about the sysadmin industrial complex that is needed to perpetrate and defend or at least make resilient this international global liberal trade order. But as I read through it, especially the history part of this chapter, where you say the two most important developments that allowed this burgeoning to occur, Deng Xiaoping's embrace of managed capitalism,
right,
authoritarian capitalism, and the Thatcher-Reagan deregulation of international financial markets. And you talk about the radical increase in velocity, volume, variety, and visibility of market transactions.
Right.
Aren't we living through the consequences of the truism that speed kills, that we've gotten so fast that these capital flows turned on us in October of last year and just trashed the system?
Well, you know, I would say after a 27-year boom triggered in 1982, you know, so all those who predicted doom were wrong for 27 years, and then like a broken clock, they were right, you know, every 27th year when we finally come a cropper in 2009. In any long boom like that, you attract bad habits over time. I mean, we have almost a generation and a half of people who haven't lived through hard times, okay, and they get experimental. They start thinking the rules don't apply. That happens on a regular rhythm on Wall Street. What happened this time, though, my argument is, and I got this, I spoke recently at a big convention of investors out in Phoenix, and the rationale I got from them was uniform. They don't look at this as a business crisis. They really look at this more as a structural crisis, meaning we went as far as we could in that Bretton Woods II kind of implicit agreement we had with Asia. We'll keep enabling your export-driven growth as long as you take your trade surpluses and plow it back into our debt markets, allow us to play security Leviathan there. I mean, that went as well and as long as it could. They couldn't save anymore. They couldn't export anymore. We couldn't import anymore. We couldn't go into debt anymore. So that restructuring of that major relationship, which was highly beneficial. I mean, we had a wonderful long run here. We paid for it in terms of a certain amount of overleverage, not uncommon in U.S. history. We've done it in the past. We had a big crisis like this in 1906, 07, 08, that time frame. So we've done this before, and then we have a new austerity, and we have a new commitment to saving and stuff like that. And social, you know, we're great at paradigm shifts, this culture. You just can't shock us to death. If you get a big enough crisis, we'll change our behavior almost on a dime, which is one of our great strengths. But there is going to have to be this big structural adjustment. In that process, though, there was all sorts of new risk management tools that were promulgated by Wall Street, which I think is good on average. They do good things. They help us figure out how to manage risk in a more systematic fashion. But this time, the double whammy that hit us was not only that big transaction strategy we had going with Asia comes a cropper. It hits a maximum wall. But we had a very high trust environment experimenting with very sophisticated risk management tools and then selling those things to lesser trust environments, less sophisticated markets, and other people in the world who bought into all those schemes, you know, the subprime and all the collateralized debt obligations. They just didn't know what they were buying. I mean, the system kind of pulled the wool over the eyes of a lot of investors who weren't sophisticated and experienced enough to know the danger they were getting into.
Do you think the velocity that marks this chapter, as you chart what's happened over the last quarter century, might also mark a repair of the damage that given the technologies now at our command and the information flows that now occur on a routine basis with the computerization of the world, that the repair of the damage can be quick?
Right. I mean, you're an optimist like I am. I agree. I mean, I think that's an underlying point of the Black Swan book, Nicholas Taleb, If we are in a more recursive environment, you know, I mean, the reason why a cut on your tongue heals very fast, your tongue has a very recursive environment. There's a lot of blood there, so it can manage that solution very, very quickly. Or like a young child, like I had a kid who got cancer when she was two. That kid can regenerate really fast. So you can do a lot of tough things to that kid in terms of the cure. You know, a more recursive, networked, global environment has more workarounds, has more healing capacity, more regenerative capacity. So, you know, we got this news just this week from the IMF, which until recently was predicting a 2% drop in global trade. And what you saw in the early 30s was like 3 to 5% drop a year, several years in a row. Now they're saying this year is going to be about 9%. And, you know, when you look at that number, you're like, oh, my God, in terms of the velocity and all the arguments we're making here, that is a stunner. I bet you we can recover a lot faster than we realize.
We'll be right back with Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett, author of Great Powers. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. Stay tuned.
The Hugh Hewitt Hotline is sponsored by the franchisees of Mathnasium Learning Centers, teaching kids math the way that makes sense to them. To request parent or franchise information, call 877-MATH-201.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Continuing a series of conversations with Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett about his new book, Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. It's been a fascinating series, lots of extraordinary email asking that it go on and on. Well, it goes on for a few more weeks at least. And this is the chapter about interconnectedness, resilience, and threats to that resilience and interconnectedness. Dr. Barnett, first let's talk about the global food chain, because it was fascinating how you sort of predict the international market for Wisconsin milk based upon 3 billion new Chinese who want to increase their caloric intake. But there's also rising vulnerability as we interconnect all of this, and you don't slide over that, but we do have these revanchists out there, these recidivists in centuries term, that such interconnectedness presents to them targets of great opportunity.
Sure. You know, we've talked historically about NBC, nuclear, biological, chemical, weapons of mass destruction, and the order of that is really wrong. It's really CNB in terms of history. You think of the 19th century as the century of chemistry, so lo and behold, you have chemical weapons, World War One. Okay, 20th century, century of physics, lo and behold, you have nuclear weapons at the end of World War II. 21st century, definitely going to be a biologically focused century. So if you're thinking about terrorism, and this is one of the reasons why I don't like us to obsess so much on nukes, much more interested in biological, I think that's where the real dangers start to appear. And if you think about this in terms of a global scale, there are four chunks of the world that are really net exporters of foodstuffs in the form of grain, which is the basic stuff we all kind of survive on, rices and corn and all that kind of stuff. There's Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, that's one. There's Australia, New Zealand, that's another, having a bit of a drought right now. There's the ABC countries, Argentina, Brazil, Chile. And then there's the OPEC of grain, North America. Okay, the amount of grain that actually moves in a net fashion around the planet, it's about 150 million metric tons. We supply about 70% of it. Okay,
wow.
That is powerful stuff. I mean, we supplied 70% of cotton in 1850. We were dominant in that time frame. OPEC controls, you know, on that kind of order, not in terms of production, but obviously in terms of reserves. So I like to say if OPEC has us over an oil barrel, we got them over a breadbasket. Because if you look at the Middle East, massive food importers. Now, you overlay climate change on that, okay, and what you find is it gets easier or okay in terms of the future growing farther away you get from the equator. So the places I named as those four sources are all fairly far from the equator, meaning we're going to be able to grow food where we can grow food now, but the places along the equator where we can't grow food, where 80% of the population growth is going to happen in the next 30, 40 years, that's going to get a lot hotter, okay, and a lot drier, much more droughts. So you talk about food historically very much where it's grown and where it's harvested, co-located. I grow food in my backyard, I eat it, okay? History is going to be in the future, the argument is going to be that food is going to be one of the most longest traveling resources in the system because of that map I just laid out for you. A lot of people aren't going to have food where the population growth is highest and where the global warming impact is greatest, and the people who have lesser populations are going to be the ones who can grow more food. So much like energy today, we harvest it in one part of the world, consume it largely in another part, making energy networks seemingly the most important, vulnerable networks. We fight wars over these things, Okay, that's all going to be replaced when you locally generate energy a lot more in the future, and you're going to see food, which has historically been harvested and consumed in the same place, now travels about 1,500 miles on average to your dinner table. That's going to double and triple, I would argue, in length. And the small percentages of dairy and grains that are traded now, 7 to 10% across borders, you're going to see those percentages double and triple. And that's going to mean food is the most vulnerable, important, decisive global network there is. And that co-locates that phenomenon with this biological threat in a biological century, telling me that that's the thing I really want to worry about. That's where I want to get my sensors and my transparency and my resilience built into the system.
Now, you also argue here that that deterrence doesn't make sense when, in fact, or retaliation doesn't make sense when, in fact, it breaks the very networks that you're trying to build, establish, protect, defend, and extend. But if that's the case, if retaliation doesn't make sense, how do you deter?
Well, we take deterrence from the nuclear realm, okay? And the realm there is, you know, very much a huge retaliation, an absurdly over-proportional retaliation that says to the other side, don't even think about this, because if you do, we're all going to die. You're not going to get anything, okay? You really can't do that with networks. You can't kind of cut people off from networks, especially because the networks tend to be so pervasive and so invasive in these situations, that most of the friction we meet, most of the resistance we meet, I argue, is a demand for identity retention. Okay? People want to feel like they can retain their identity despite being absorbed by this Borg-like phenomenon, this network where you will be assimilated and homogenized in their mind. You know, that American cultural remix kind of phenomenon. So I say what you got to do is understand that that is a demand function. Okay, terrorists are not a supply you can reduce any more than you can reduce the drug problem in America by going after supply. You have to reduce demand. Or in this case, you have to meet people's demand to feel like they're going to be able to retain their identity. So there are some compromises you have to make with this networking function. You're going to have to allow for a certain amount of content control. I always say everybody wants the connectivity. You know, I want my satellite television, okay, but I don't want Skinemax in my house, because I got a 17-year-old girl and a 14-year-old son. Okay, so I have parental control on that one. I simply don't buy that HBO Cinemax package. A similar parallel to a lot of countries around the world. They want the connectivity, but China wants to have certain controls over the Internet. Dangerous ideas as far as they're concerned. Nepal recently brought in satellite television. The first thing they wanted jacked out of it was MTV.
Yep.
Because they said too much sexual content. You know, so I think you're going to make these deals time and time again. I make the argument with the Chinese. You know, they say the Great Firewall of China and all that stuff, and these people are living a walled garden experience. They don't even know that they're living inside the matrix on the Internet because the Chinese have blocked it off really well. I say, you know, first generation, they all love the matrix in the first generation. That's why AOL.com was so darn popular in America. You had a lot of people going into this wild, wild Internet, and if you gave them this walled garden, they said, great, you know, I'm happy with the connectivity. I want a sheltered existence. So for the first generation, that kind of walled garden experience, that kind of censorship approach works. The problem is their kids. Their kids, as soon as they start feeling the wall of that matrix, they want to hack their way through it. They want to take the red pill and emerge on the other side, Alice in Wonderland, and you are gone, and you can't control that kind of connectivity. So when a connectivity phenomenon comes to China and we see them go from nothing to 300 million Internet users, and then they make demands on Google and Yahoo and these various connecting companies and Internet providers and search engines, I say let them make their compromises at first, because the connectivity will change behavior. Don't worry about the first generation and what kind of taboos they want to place on the connectivity, their demand for content control. Trust that their kids are ultimately going to demand more freedom.
I'll be right back.
A real revolutionary.
Dr. Thomas P.M. Benedetta is my guest. His book is Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. We're talking about the evolution of this liberal global world trade order that we are part of, the crisis of which is enveloping us in the last 6 months. But what's ahead and who's going to guide us out? More on that when we come back. The book, Great Powers, is linked at HughHewitt.com. It's available at Amazon.com. It's in bookstores everywhere. We'll be right back.
The Hugh Hewitt Hotline is sponsored by the franchisees of Mathnasium Learning Center, teaching kids math the way that makes sense to them. To request parent or franchise information, call 877-MATH-201.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, continuing my series of conversations with Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett a strategist, author. His new book, Great Powers, America and the World After Bush, as bracing and as transformative for many people as his first New York Times bestselling book, The Pentagon's New Map, which just shot up bestselling charts a few years back and greatly influenced strategic thinking inside the Pentagon and across the globe. Dr. Barnett, on pages 297 and 298, you give kind of a brief look at your professional life and the life of Entera, your corporation. And as I was reading through that, I thought to myself, you know, no wonder you're an optimist. You've had all of these vastly important inputs, these very expensive technical add-ons. The Harvard PhD is sort of the equivalent of vast oil deposits. The Pentagon credentialing with the New York Times bestseller makes you completely credible and trustworthy in the world. But you represent something as a result, sort of apogee man, that the rest of the gap, and not even the gap, but the near-gap countries can't hope to replicate. And I know you talk a lot about people who stand in that gap and translate, provide the expertise, but I don't know if there are enough of those or if they will be trusted by the gap countries, because you arrive, and people like you arrive, as their middlemen, and I don't even know how they translate you. It's like the Borg. You must be threatening to them.
Well, I tell you, I do a lot of speaking in kind of developing countries and emerging markets. I'm going to Turkey soon. I go to China on a regular basis. And I find, you know, my kind of message, again, for the older generation, tends to be kind of flabbergasting. I mean, they really find it kind of frightening. It's just a little too much too fast. They're just getting used to this package. And like anybody, you know, as they age, you know, there's only so many new technological things. My mom's 84, and she's like, I don't do attachments. You know, I draw the line at attachments. And she's 84, and she's made that decision. But, you know, you'd start talking to the young people, and that's my favorite thing in these countries, is to go talk to graduate students and lecture at universities. Man, their ability to adapt themselves to this kind of opportunity is stunning.
Aren't they worried that the Steve DeAngelis's and Admiral Ehrlich and the rest of you doing development of Box, that you're just Cecil Rhodes and King Leopold with better marketing?
Well, the difference is you got to be empowering to the local. I mean, what we call development in a box is, you know, I make the comparison to a general contractor in a subdivision. Okay, you want to build a house in my subdivision, I'm going to give you the connectivity package. I'm going to give you the water and the sewer connection. I'm going to give you the electricity. I'm going to give you the cable. I'm going to give you the internet. I'm not going to negotiate that kind of stuff because that's already been decided in our subdivision called the global economy. You know, so you tell people the connectivity package. You don't negotiate. You mandate. You push that package to them. You make that your aid. Okay, and then you let them decide how they're going to organize their house, so to speak, their family, how they're going to live their lives. So you never try to impose externally models that are very culturally driven, okay? So I'm going to tell you the rough size of the windows in your house and how tall your stairs got to be, because we've decided in terms of building over centuries, this is what makes a solid house, and these are the rules and regulations, the architectural code that makes sense. But, you know, I shouldn't be in the business of telling you how to get along with your wife or how to raise your children or what God to worship and how, or how, you know, how to cook food or any of those kinds of things. You mandate the connectivity, give people the opportunity, and then you let them make of it what they will. We find time and time again, the average person, even uneducated, illiterate, stuns us with their ability. You know, cell phones are selling like crazy in rural India. People will buy them there. Farmers will buy them before they put a toilet in their house. That's how much they value this connectivity. Why? All of a sudden, they're not waiting 8 hours on a truck on a dusty road to come buy their wares. I mean, they call when they want them, and they go there. The time savings, the ability to stay connected to their family while they're out in the fields, the ability to check market prices, you know, this kind of stuff, we constantly underestimate what people will do with it. Kenya has gone so wild with cell phones that people use cell phone minutes as a currency, you know, and who, you know, you and I would have spent the rest of our lives never figuring that one out, because it never would have occurred to us.
Now, in terms of the key question at the end of this chapter is, the Asian substitutes are competing with, well, with the Entera substitutes. And, we've got all these young military guys who are back now going off and doing this. We got less than a minute to the break. Are the Asians going to be better at this than us because they are less demanding on the culture side?
Well, they're less demanding on the political side, but they tend not to have the same good rules that we have. I mean, the standards and the stringency and the transparency that's demanded by our system, in part because we're litigious, because we sue people if they don't keep their contracts and whatnot, makes our rules much more robust. So dealing with us gives you global standards. Dealing with the Chinese, I mean, you can certainly tap into demand for your resources, but you really want to always have the West in there in many ways, because we bring the good rules. And that's what makes the gift that keeps on giving, the connectivity, really start to flow.
We'll come back, talk about the Chinese again, as we seem to do every week. Reason for that, obviously, is because they're there every week. With Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett, his book, Great Powers, America and the World After Bush, we continue the conversation. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.
The Hugh Hewitt Hotline is sponsored by the franchisees of Mathnasium Learning Centers, teaching kids math the way that makes sense to them. To request parent or franchise information, call 877-MATH-201.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. The sixth week of my conversation with Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett, author of Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. As you can tell, I'm very enthusiastic about this book, even though we disagree on some key points. On this chapter, though, not much. In fact, in this chapter about the build-out of the sysadmin operating system for the global liberal trade order, I found a couple of things I want to bring to our attention, the audience, Dr. Barnett. You quote the Bush administration's Millennium Strategy, the private sector is our exit strategy from conflict. And you write, victory means getting off the front page of the New York Times and onto the business advertising section of the Wall Street Journal. And you use Macedonia as an example. Give a quick summary of that.
Well, you know, Macedonia was one of those parts of Yugoslavia that broke off with little violence. It kind of slipped away in the middle of all the tumult and the interventions from the outside world and the big fight over Bosnia-Herzegovina. What's interesting is, you know, 8-10 years ago, nobody would have gone to Macedonia. But I started noticing these ads about a year and a half, 2 years ago. They were in Business Week, they're in The Economist, they're in The Wall Street Journal. It's this wonderful ad. It says, invest in Macedonia, business heaven. You know, and it's one of those kind of weird uses of English by a foreign culture, and you're kind of like, what is a business heaven? And you realize this was a small country that wired itself for, like, Wi-Fi, okay, on a simple USAID, official developmental aid program, and then just started attracting attention from the outside world by offering, you know, like free trade zones, free enterprise zones. You know, we'll give you a sewer hookup. We won't tax you for 10 years. We'll give you all sorts of breaks on this and that. Come here, you access Macedonia, you get to access the EU, you get to access all these, you know, like 700 million consumers really quickly. And what really drew my attention to this ad was that they showed Macedonia and then they had rings around it. You know, like X miles and X miles and X miles. And being a military kind of thinker, I look at that and I thought, my God, that's the missile range.
Huh.
You know, they're showing how far their missiles reach. And then I realized what they were advertising was, this is how quickly, in terms of rail and interstate and air corridors, you can reach all these industry players, you can reach all these consumers. And I thought, boy, I got to get countries from the map that shows their missile ranges, that shows their connectivity to markets. That's what I call victory.
Now, the alternative to it, as you spell out, is that you can go the Macedonian way, which is basically our way with their overlay, or the alternative is China's updated version, I'm quoting you here, of Imperial Japan's co-prosperity sphere. Now, that took me aback, because that's a very negative way of casting what China is about. It's sort of what I think China is about, but you are much more an unabashed enthusiast for China's way. Do you think they have the same dangers implicit that overtook the co-prosperity sphere?
Well, they don't have the ideological ambition. I mean, they certainly will abuse you in a business sense as much as the Westerners did before. Okay, capitalism makes kind of brutes of all of you. And if there's unequal counterparty capacity, you and I want to do a deal, you're very unsophisticated, I'm very sophisticated, I do nasty, cruel things to you because, you know, I have more power, I'm more sophisticated in doing these kinds of things. If we're more equal in our counterparty capacity, I can't pull the wool off over your eyes. So we have China going into some fairly unsophisticated situations where China's, you know, bribing its way, using very shady, corrupt business practices. You know, not unlike, you know, how people did things in the American West, say, in 1860. You know, money under the table and brute force and corporations coming in with their own security and that kind of stuff. It's a nasty, rough form. If left untended in terms of a global community that comes in and forces China to do better, China could very well replicate a lot of the same mercantilist practices in Africa that the Europeans did. Okay, the answer to that is the same kind of thing that got Toyota to start building Toyotas in America. Okay, you start saying to this place, you can't simply take our money and sell us goods. You gotta let us in on the production that gets devoted to our own market. So the way that Toyota became a globally integrated enterprise, it was forced by angry populations, like in Indiana, where if you drove a Toyota 10 years ago in Indiana, you'd get your car keyed by locals who hated it because we built GM and we built Ford and stuff like that here, and foreign cars weren't allowed. How did they solve that kind of response from your average Indiana citizen? They started putting Toyota factories here. Okay, so China will be forced down this pathway, I argue, by the Africans who are already catching on to the fact that they're replicating what Europe did to them 100 years ago. And the good news is China actually looks as Africa as kind of the next stage for its replication as China ages and moves up the production chain. They need to foist off lower-end production to places where they want to conquer not just the markets but tap the labor.
Will China, though, become impatient the way Imperial Japan did, unwilling to live by that rule set and taking what it wants at some point from where it needs to get it?
I think that's an overblown fear, and I'll tell you why. My fear is more that China won't do anything nearly close to what it needs to do to actually defend its interests. They are totally free-riding on the system. They have very great reticence to back up their economic interests with any sort of what I would consider appropriate military presence around the world, in part because they don't want to trigger any sort of rivalry with the United States, but in part because they like to free ride. And, you know, my problem with them is, you guys are bringing globalization. This is what I tell them every time I go to Beijing. You're bringing globalization, and after a while, Africans are going to start killing your people. They're going to start targeting your oil rigs in eastern Ethiopia like they did the rebels last year, killing a bunch of Chinese oil workers, and they're going to start saying you're the bad people that are bringing unfair globalization to us. And eventually, China's going to be forced to go into some sort of expansion of its military presence around the world, or there's going to be a tension built up with us because they're going to put us in the role of being on the hook for that, and resentment will build on that basis, which I think is unhealthy. I think they need to step up. They need to start participating more and more. I think there's an overlap of interests between us. We have political military interests largely for Africa. We don't want to see radical Salafi jihadists penetrate from the north and start to radicalize that situation, which is a real danger, I would argue. Not a great one, but a real one, something we want to outflank. And we know that we don't have the economic interests that the Chinese do because we don't need that kind of raw material access that they do given their level of development. So the kind of marriage we need to bring is we need to come in and say, hey, you need to work with us on the military and the political development, and we'll help you on the infrastructure development, okay, and your access to markets. You're starting to see a glimpse of that. New Deal just gone down in Afghanistan. You know, we're not going to access, like, manganese in Afghanistan. We're just not going to make the effort, the West. China will, okay? So their infrastructure, their road building, stuff like that, if they need American security to make it happen, then you start to see an overlap of interest, some possibility to real partnership.
I'll be right back. Final segment of this hour with Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett. The book we're discussing is Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. Stay tuned.
The Hugh Hewitt Hotline is sponsored by the franchisees of Mathnasium Learning Centers, teaching kids math the way that makes sense to them. To request parent or franchise information, call 877-MATH-201.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt with Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett in our penultimate conversation about his book, Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. We will conclude next week with the rest and the balance of the book. Dr. Barnett, in this chapter, there is a phrase of yours. You say you insourced your most recent job from China, meaning you adopted. I chuckled about that, but I also thought that probably reflects, I'm assuming here, your Catholic Christian background, you and your wife. And I went on to ask myself whether or not that Christian faith that powered the work ethic and the savings rate, as well as the restraint in war that we have practiced, that faith that doesn't just see us taking Venezuela's oil as Rome would have done, if that's really factored in, the absence of that is factored into your assessment of places like China. I mean, that's just not in their DNA, and it is in ours.
I would tell you that Chinese history, the vast, you know, everything except for a 30-year period very recently under Mao, China was an amazingly spiritual country, strong religious background, and fairly tolerant of a number of religions.
Okay, but in terms of the Protestant work ethic and the generosity of spirit, is that part of that spiritual legacy that they have?
I think what you're seeing right now is a huge blossoming, and we've talked about this in the past, of religion inside of China. It's one of the things they fear, the underground Catholic movement, the Protestants, the evangelicals, the Mormons. I mean, everybody's reporting boom numbers inside of China. Why is that? I mean, when you talk to Chinese, they will tell you, you know, a guy my age, 30, 40, something like that, they'll say, I was raised with absolutely no religion. You know, I was completely unchurched, okay? And now my life is changing dramatically. And I'm getting married, and I'm trying to, you know, figure out why I should stay married to my wife, and if I have children, why I should be responsible for my children. And I look around, and I see all the images of the consumeristic society, and none of them are fitting the bill for me. You know, and then they start reaching for religion big time. So I think the religious boom inside of China is going to be massive. It's going to be a great awakening on the scale we saw in America, say, in the 1820s. You know, every big social progressive movement in America, you know, anti-abolition, okay, you think about the prohibition of liquor, the progressive era, you think about civil rights, you think about anti-abortion in the United States, all these things are driven by church mobilization efforts. We're going to see China have a huge blossoming of churches and religious population over the next 20, 30 years, and it's going to trigger a massive amount of progressive era kind of tactics. And one of the key places we're already seeing this is the environmental movement.
We will talk about that progressive era or the return of the progressive era as he does in Chapter 8 next week. Dr. Thomas P.M. Barnett, always a pleasure. Another fascinating conversation. Once again, America, the book is Great Powers, America and the World After Bush. I've linked it at HughHewitt.com. It is soaring up bestseller lists across the country. You'll really enjoy it. I am out now, turning the microphone over to Generalissimo Duane for the Fred and Morton conversation and the movie Hour Beyond. Enjoy it, and I'll be back on Monday on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
From Joel C. Rosenberg, the New York Times best-selling author of The Last Jihad and Epicenter, comes a must-read new book, Inside the Revolution. Using exclusive interviews with top intelligence officials, generals, and Mideast leaders, Inside the Revolution takes you inside the world of radical Islamic leaders, their hatred of Jews and Christians, their apocalyptic religious beliefs. Inside the Revolution, on sale now from Tyndale House Publishers. Available now at joelrosenberg.com.